from 7:30.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
And it's midday, time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Kevin O'Hare is the director of the Royal Ballet, and he probably finds it hard to remember a time when dance wasn't part of his life. He started young and joined the Royal Ballet School at the age of 11. He went on to dance with Sadler's Wells and Birmingham Royal Ballet, taking on roles such as Prince Siegfried in Swan Lake, Albrecht in Giselle, and Romeo in Kenneth Macmillan's Romeo and Juliet. He retired from the stage in 2000 at the age of 35, but before long he was back in the world of dance, this time behind the scenes. By 2009 he was administrative director of the Royal Ballet and oversaw their first tour to Cuba. 3 years later he became overall director. He's since worked with a huge range of dancers, choreographers and composers, and helped steer the company through the COVID crisis. Kevin, we're going to hear works by Thomas Addis, Rachmaninoff, Anna Klein, but first, Tchaikovsky.
Yes, wonderful Tchaikovsky. And I think the Sleeping Beauty, for me, it was the first full-length ballet I saw. Madame Dame Ninette de Valois, who founded the Royal Ballet, had recreated the Sleeping Beauty, and it opened with two great dancers of that time, the amazing Anthony Dow and Leslie Collier. And Sleeping Beauty has stayed with me all my life, from that moment through to when I did my school performance with Viviana Durante and Miyako Yoshida, and then throughout my time with the Royal Ballet. And it is a signature work of the Royal Ballet. And sometimes, maybe, behind the scenes, dancers might groan about the Sleeping Beauty, because it's one of our longest ballets. It's a good 3 hours. But there's something about the overture that as soon as those chords start, the first notes, I feel like I'm a little kid again and excited.
Thank you. The overture from Sleeping Beauty by Tchaikovsky, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andre Previn. It's those tunes as well as the dynamism, isn't it?
Yes, totally. And I think in that little two-minute section of the overture, you hear the good and the evil in that music and in those tunes. And I always feel, you know, it's all going to end well. And, you know, it gives you hope, I think, in your heart as you hear those chords at the end.
And of course, it demonstrated, as you just mentioned, that thing that music almost uniquely can do. It can change a mood within the fraction of a second, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why dance goes so well with music and ballet, particularly that we can do that as well and we can interpret that. I think Sleeping Beauty is probably the greatest of the scores. It's hard, you sort of, you know, hesitate when you say that, but I think Swan Lake is very, very different, but Sleeping Beauty is such a masterpiece and I think it's helped make that ballet survive, really, over the years.
I wonder what it is about those Russian composers, because if we were to talk about an also-ran in the greatest stakes, Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev would have to be up there, wouldn't it?
Of course.
And then we get Stravinsky and Shostakovich. What do you think it was that...
I don't know. I suppose I never danced in Russia. And it's only since I've been a director that I've been over there for certain things. And then I took the company to the Bolshoi in, I think it was 2014. And it was amazing, actually. I did a press moment in this room in the Bolshoi, and they said to me, this is where Tchaikovsky signed his contract for the Sleeping Beauty, which was sort of amazing. But every time I've gone there, just ballet is in the air. And maybe that's where that connection has come with those Russian composers, because it's, you don't escape it. You know that ballet is a big thing when you're in Russia.
Kevin O'Hare, you grew up, as you said, not in Russia, but in Hull, where very early on you were introduced to the world of dance. How did that come about?
A lot of young men in ballet have this story where their sister went. And especially in my day, you know, it was every little girl went to the Saturday ballet class. And so my sister Anne went to ballet class. And she was closer in age to my brother. They're a bit older than me. So Michael, my brother, just went along and watched. And the teacher then encouraged him to get up and dance as well and said, you know, boys can do this. So by the time I was of the age to start doing things, have hobbies, dance was our hobby, and it just seemed like the most natural thing to do in the world.
So perhaps because of the family connections, there weren't quite the same stigma problems that we saw in Billy Elliot.
Yes, not at all. And, you know, my mother was a musician. She played the piano, she sang, she played in the violin as well. And we used to do little competitions. She used to play for us at those competitions. So there'd be moments when we're in the living room at home, there was a piano there, and we'd be practicing our little variation for the competition, you know, and my dad loved it. And so there was just encouragement all the way. And interestingly, at school, really didn't get any sort of bullying. And I was at a normal state school, you know, in Hull. I think it helped because we were doing all types of dancing. And so both Michael and I started doing little bits on television. And famously, I was in, my claim to fame is that I was in the movie Bugsy Malone, directed by Alan Parker, which was a great experience. And I think all of those things made it quite cool that I was dancing and was able to have those experiences. So my classmates were sort of going, well done, you know, rather than, oh, why are you doing that? Because they could see what the results were, that I was having these fantastic experiences.
So in a way, perhaps rather than taking up an instrument, although maybe you did that as well, your body was the instrument through which you expressed your love of music and dance.
Yeah, completely. I didn't really play an instrument very well. I did learn the piano and was not great at the piano. I could sing and hold a tune, but really everything was done through dance. And I used to watch all the old movies on television, Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, all of those. And because my parents were interested, you know, we went to the theatre really early on. We came from a very normal background, but theatre was just part of our lives.
Those films you mentioned loving included, as you suggested, musicals, and I think that's what informs your next choice, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. I mean, musicals are definitely something that stayed with me all my life. I love going to see musicals. I love what they can do with an audience, the joy they bring. But it's interesting because in ballet, you tend to go a lot to see the same production and you'll see different dancers, and that's part of it. But with musicals and plays, I'm always afraid to go and see it again because, you know, I loved it so much the first time. But there's one musical, Cabaret, which I saw the film at a certain age. And then it's probably the thing I've seen so many different productions of. And mostly each time it surprised me. Most recently, the production that's now on at the Playhouse, but it's the Kit Kat Club, they're calling it, and they're doing it in a new way that you walk back through the back of the stage and everything. Seeing this production, it was like seeing it afresh again, and a fantastic cast with Eddie Redmayne and Jesse Buckley.
Well, which number have you homed in on?
Well, I thought maybe this time, you know, and I thought she sang this brilliantly in the show, and I think it really got to the crux of the story and that character.
The truth is, we're drifting. We have no focus to our lives. A baby would make all the difference. I know it would to me. I'd get a job. I'd have to. I'd stay home nights. I'd write the novel. I'd wash the diapers, the whole bit. Listen, Sally, will you do one thing for me, please? At least think about it before you see the doctor.
Maybe this time I'll be lucky. Maybe this time he'll stay. Maybe this time, for the first time, love won't hurry away. Anymore, like the last time and the time before. Everybody loves a winner, so nobody loved me. Lady peaceful, lady happy. That's what I long to be. All the odds are in my favor. Something's bound to begin. It's got to happen. Happen sometime. Maybe this time I'll Everybody loves a winner, so nobody loved me. Lady peaceful, lady happy, that's what I long to be.
It was a good performance.
Yeah, amazing. I think she was so extraordinary. And I loved her physicality as well. I mean, she's got an incredible voice there, but the physicality of the performance really came through.
Jesse Buckley and the London cast of Candor and Ebb's Cabaret in 2021. You went, Kevin O'Hare, thanks to your parents, to a residential summer school where I think you encountered ballet dancers of really very considerable standing.
Yeah, it was extraordinary, really. And this was still at the time when I was thinking I was going to be in cabaret. You know, that's what I thought I was going to do. But then this amazing man called David Gale, who was a ballet dancer with the Royal Ballet, but was from Yorkshire, from Ilkley, he saw that there was a gap. There were some great dance schools in Yorkshire, but that there was maybe a gap for teachers from outside of that world and from London, from the Royal Ballet, but also from the really greater world of ballet. And so it was sort of extraordinary time to be around. And so there I was coached by all these people, you know, notably, you know, people from the Ballet Russe, you know. So Dame Alicia Markova, Danilova, you know, Alexandra Danilova, Irina Baronova.
Markova was one of only two people, wasn't she, to be called prima ballerina assoluta. Just explain the significance of that.
Well, it's very hard to put your finger on what makes a prima ballerina assoluta. And I think for me, it sort of means somebody that's put an indelible mark on the world of ballet and maybe the company they've worked with. And
so, like Fontaine.
Like Fontaine.
Who was also, yeah,
prima ballerina. But of course, Alicia Markova, apart from being with the Ballet Russe, was also really the first ballerina of the Royal Ballet. And a great one for me was Anton Dolin, you know, who was, I would say, probably the first great male classical dancer from England. I think he has Irish connections as well. And he just really helped coach me, took a shine to me and thought that I had some talent. I remember going out antique shopping with him even, and he was telling me how Diaghilev had told him how to recognise a real pearl, you know, that you have to put it in the mouth and see the grit. And I, you know, here's a kid from Hull, you know, what did I know about pearls? But it was sort of extraordinary. And actually somebody came up to my mother, who was a notator at the Royal Ballet School, Hilary Condren, and she said, oh, has your son thought about going to the Royal Ballet School? And my mother said, oh, yes, he is thinking. She was talking about my older brother, Michael. And she said, no, the little one. So I auditioned and joined White Lodge.
You mentioned about notating, the idea that you can write down choreography in the same way that you can write down music. Just tell us a little bit about that.
So the Benesch method was created by Joan and Rudolf Benesch. And it's, interestingly, very like music. So you have a stave. The staves sort of divide the body up. And then you create little figures that actually say whether your hip is up or your leg is up or your leg is out. And it's incredible. I mean, the people that do it are geniuses, really.
And without that, you wouldn't have a record necessarily of choreography, would you? It would have to be passed down, which of course it is,
yes,
by word of
mouth. Of course, nowadays we have video and people use that, but there's nothing like the Benesch notation because they're there with the choreographer at all times.
So you did apply for the Royal Ballet School, got in, at the age of 11?
Yes, 11.
And what was that like, leaving Hull, your mum and your dad, and finding yourself here?
It was sort of extraordinary, and I think what's brilliant about somewhere like White Lodge is to be there with like-minded people, but from all walks of life, you know. So I was this normal kid from Hull. One of my great friends, Simonetta, was from Italy, who came from a really fantastic musical family. Her grandmother had saved the resistance in Italy and had this wonderful home in Tuscany, and really different lives. But they all came together for this love of ballet. And they're all still my closest friends now. Even though most of them left the ballet world quite soon, we've got that time together that was so important.
I'm sensing not only a fairly confident spirit, but quite a romantic one, Kevin. And that takes us to the next music.
Yes, well, one of the things that's amazing about the life of a dancer is literally every day we are surrounded by live music, and we have amazing pianists that play for our classes and our rehearsals. Gosh, how lucky are we to walk in and have that every day? They have to play for the rehearsals, but then a lot of the time they then go on and play for us on stage. And of course, sometimes with choreographers, they maybe don't want the speeds that are written by the composer. And so the pianists have to adapt to that and, you know, sometimes maybe against their musicianship, but they understand and they know the dancers so well and they know the choreography so well. And so the piece, which I adore from the Ballet Rhapsody, but Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, which was created by Sir Frederick Ashton for the Queen Mother's 80th birthday, they invited the great Russian star Mikhail Baryshnikov to come and dance with the equally great Leslie Collier. And this recording is by the brilliant Stephen Huff. I remember going to see a concert at the Proms. I was sat beside the ballet critic, Deborah Crane, and it finished, and it was so fast. I mean, it was incredibly fast. And we do it quite a bit slower because everybody has to dance to it. And she just turned around, and we have this amazing dancer called Stephen McRae, who became famous for this role. And she just turned around to me and said, even Stephen McRae couldn't dance it that fast. And I was like, yeah, you're right. So somehow we have to marry that within the ballet. What the composer would want, what the choreographer would want, and what the dancers need. But when it all comes together, like Rhapsody, it's sheer perfection, really.
It's a wonderfully mischievous ending, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, the wit and the cleverness within the music is reflected in the ballet as well.
We heard the end of the Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, played by Stephen Hough, with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Litton, which reminds me that he's coming to you, isn't he?
That's right. He's coming to work with us for Nutcracker this year. Our music director is Coon Kessels now, and together with the former one, Barry Wordsworth, they've really encouraged how exciting it is to be a conductor for ballet, and we've got two programmes to look at ballet conducting as a career.
And as an art in itself,
exactly.
Not merely an also-run.
Yeah, and, you know, those two conductors are the great ballet conductors of their time, you know, and so it's wonderful that they can then mentor the next one.
Returning, Kevin O'Hare, to your days as a mere stripling, in 1984 you graduated into Sadler's Wells. What kind of roles were you doing then?
Well, at the beginning, like everybody, I worked my way up, you know, so I went through the Corps de Ballet, which is a really important thing to do. Sadler's Wells Royal Ballet at that time was really touring a lot. Did the big tops. I love the big tops. It's something that I'm quite passionate about because it really brought ballet to people that wouldn't have it, where there wasn't theatres. And so we were in Lancaster at the time. There was no theatre in Milton Keynes. We also went to Leeds Castle, went to the Isle of Wight. But those first couple of years, we toured America, India, went to New Zealand with the company. So they were really good, fun times, you know, learning. But then at one point, then you think, OK, I better start thinking about...
Well, which roles were you dying to do and which ones did you get?
I suppose I wanted to do those big classics, you know. So I wanted to be Siegfried. I wanted to be Albrecht. And actually, my first major full-length role was Albrecht, which is a hard one for a young person, you know, because it's quite a deep character and you can play it very many different ways. And I think as I got older, I played it in a different way than I did when I was a young, you know, 20-year-old. But as soon as I got a taste of that, I really wanted it and worked tirelessly hard to, especially because I was a tall guy and I was very lucky at the school, actually, in my last year. Michael Soames, who was the great partner and dancer of Margot Fonteyn, he coached me for my school performance and he brought to me a love of partnering and how important it is. And so I really enjoyed working on that and becoming the best sort of partner I could, because it's so important in those big classics that you work as a team, as two becomes one, you know. It's just really so incredible that you don't know where one dancer starts and the other finishes.
Sadler's Wells, of course, became Birmingham Royal Ballet, and you relocated there. Were there any particular pieces that were important to you at that stage?
Yes, it was a big deal moving to Birmingham. I was just promoted to principal dancer, so of course it was a great moment. And I think that first year I did something like 15 debuts in big major ballets, you know. But the big moment for me was we brought Romeo and Juliet into the repertoire. So the production by Kenneth Macmillan, choreography, with Peter Wright, who was the director at the time, they decided to do a new version of it. So using the choreography, but with new designs. And of course, we're all very excited. I'd grown up on that production, you know, from the school, loved it. Might be biased, but for me, it's the greatest production of Romeo and Juliet there is. And to actually work with Kenneth Macmillan on that was sort of incredible. And I ended up doing the opening night with Nina Machinavelli, a ballerina from the Bolshoi Ballet. And I was lucky enough then to dance that role many, many times. And to be able to grow in a role like that is quite special.
It must be very strange to suddenly stop dancing. I mean, I think you probably kept up some of the exercises. No, you didn't.
I went cold turkey, absolutely cold turkey, yeah.
You didn't do the odd pirouette somewhere at the opera house?
Yeah, actually, I'm known to, when nobody's looking and I'm waiting for the lifts, which can be quite a long time at the opera house, I'll do a pirouette every now and again, but that's all.
After that kind of physicality, what did you feel your life would be? Or were you taken into dance administration quite soon?
At the time, I didn't think it was lucky, but I was very lucky because a couple of years before I retired, 33, I had pretty major knee injuries, literally no cartilage in my knees. So I had big operations, and so I knew that this was a sort of sign that I have to start thinking about what I'd like to do. And so I was very lucky when I decided that I wanted to stop and I wanted to retrain in management. The Royal Shakespeare Company took me on, and they really opened their doors to me, which was fascinating.
Room with a View, the film next. Tell us about this and why it's important to you and the music that comes from it.
I love film. You know, I miss actually going as much as I used to when I was a dancer. You'd have those nights off in Sunderland or Plymouth or something and you'd sneak off to the movies. But what I love about the Room with a View, brilliant actors, of course. And
Helena Bonham Carter.
Helena Bonham Carter.
And the late Julian Sands.
Yeah, I know. I was very sad when I read about his untimely death. And I even had the floppy hair and everything at that time. You know, and there's a great moment when Helena Bonham Carter and Julian Sands kiss and Maggie Smith is running through the fields after them. But suddenly there was this amazing opera aria in there. And opera is really one art form that I'd sort of missed out on, really. So it really opened. And I think that's what it does for a lot of people. You know, just as little windows for people to open so that they get a glimpse of it and think, actually, this could be for me.
It's a great romantic tune.
Yes, too. It is.
Dame Kirite Kanawa is singing O Mio Bambino Caro from Janis Geeky by Puccini.
Beautiful. Absolutely gorgeous. Takes you back to Tuscany, I think.
You're listening to Private Passions with me, Michael Barclay, where my guest this week is the director of the Royal Ballet, Kevin O'Hare. In 2012, you became director of the Royal Ballet, taking over from Dame Monica Mason. One of the things you said you wanted to do was commission a new three-act ballet every year. Have you managed to do that?
Near enough. I think that little thing called COVID got in the way. And there was one year when I thought, I think I need to give everybody a bit of a rest, you know.
One of your great successes recently, a new three-act ballet with Wayne McGregor, was to commission Thomas Addis to write the music.
Yes, and that was such a thrill because I knew Thomas's music, loved his music, and the thought of having him really create his first full-length ballet for the Royal Ballet was something that we really wanted to do. And Wayne, as always, you know, I love the work he's done with Max Richter and many other composers, and this idea came up, the Dante Project. We did it as a co-commission with the LA Philharmonic. They got to play Hell first in concert form, and then we went to LA and actually performed the first part of the whole of the Dante Project there in LA. And so it was the most exciting time and really suddenly saw that we've got, you know, a hit on our hands. And then, of course, COVID happened. And so we had to wait for 2 years, really, to bring the rest of it to the stage and to London. And there was this amazing moment. I went to the first orchestral reading, and, you know, even just to think about it now makes me goosebumps and quite emotional, because it was quite extraordinary to see our full orchestra, 80 people in a room together, playing this wonderful music that you've never heard for the first time, with Thomas conducting. And it really felt like a moment in history, you know, for the Royal Ballet to have this monumental score.
Thank
And in this particular piece, Wayne's choreography matches that amazing music so well, and you just feel you've been taken away from this world that we're all living in, and we're in a higher place.
And the hell of the earlier
bits. The hell of the earlier bits, which is always fun to see, but nice to move on from there.
The final part of Dante, Part 3, Paradiso, by Thomas Addis, performed by the Los Angeles Master Chorale with the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. So COVID really must have been perhaps worse than when the whole house shut down for refurbishment.
Oh, yeah, completely. It really knocked us for six. So we did what everybody did and got on Zoom, and we were able to send bits of liner to everybody's house. For ballet, you need to be on liner, not on carpet. And so they all had a square of liner that we could do. And then a wonderful teacher, Brian Maloney, did his classes from his house. And I even, to show solidarity, I joined in as well. But I made sure the camera was only on my top half, you know. So there's a lot of arms going on and things like that.
I'm sure if it had been on me, the camera would have been turned round 90 degrees. How did audiences react to what was happening?
There was sort of two really key moments that I remember. One was we did the last performance of Swan Lake, and I think everybody knew it was the last performance. It was going to be the last. The dancers felt it. I felt it. The audience felt it. And the applause at the end, I mean, it just makes me emotional when I think about it, because you could feel the love and people thinking, God, what's going to happen here? And then on the other side of the scale, when we first came back in, and the orchestra started to tune up and the audience just stood up and clapped for about 2 minutes, no joke. And again, it's one of those that you just can't help feeling emotional about it, because we'd all been through so much and so many highs and lows.
And of course, the whole thing of mental health and care is very topical at the moment. There have been reports of former students at leading ballet schools describing the culture as toxic, especially when it comes to weight and body shaming. Do you recognise these concerns?
We're always working on the future and looking forward and finding ways to do better, really. And of course, in the past, there's been things that we're not happy to have heard about, reports, and actually those things that have been talked about have been followed up at the time. But it's really important to learn from those lessons. We're always refreshing how we're looking after the dancers, whether it's mental health or nutrition or injury. We're just constantly trying to find out who has the best practices, how can we all do better.
To play devil's advocate for one moment, in order to get to a real peak in the arts, you do have to sometimes be ruthless with yourself, and that ruthlessness can appear to others, you know, to be bullying. But what you're doing, in fact, is demanding the best. And we think of people like George Schulte, who the orchestra used to refer to as the screaming skull, but my God, he got results. So this is a very tricky thing in the arts, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think we have learned that that way, in the end, isn't the right way. People talk about learned behaviour, but I think most people evolve and realise that, yes, I was maybe taught this way, but that isn't the way to get the best results. If you work in conversation with the person, you actually will get better results and have a better environment. And that's what we're all trying to do.
Well, you're a good person to talk about this and to sort of advocate how to do it, because of course you've been through the ringer,
yes, yeah,
if you
yeah,
like, yeah, as a young ballet dancer and as an administrator.
Yes, yeah, of course it's a very different world from when I started. You know, 1977 was when I joined White Lodge, and so I've seen those changes and seen them as a force for good. And I think you can never sit there and go, oh great, we've sorted that now, because it's always evolving. And as long as you keep your mind on that it's always going to evolve, then I think you've got a chance.
And do you feel you're also succeeding in bringing in more female choreographers and composers? Are you trying to address that?
Yeah, I mean, that's been a real focus for me. And, you know, I really didn't want it to be this sort of moment where I was just trying to tick a box. I wanted to find people that really worked well with the Royal Ballet and were the right fit. And I think we found that with those choreographers and again, with the composers as well. Crystal Pite, who's been an amazing influence on the company, but also Kathy Marsden, Kristen McNally, who's one of our dancer and is a choreographer as well, and Pan Tanowitz.
You have led us very nicely to our next music by mentioning Pan Tanowitz, because she is connected to this choice, isn't she?
Yes. She comes from a very different background from anybody at the Royal Ballet. You know, she worked in New York for many years, and we're talking about the next piece she would do, and I said, you know, I love this composer, Anna Klein. She actually has a cello concerto called Dance, so there's got to be something, like, a good connection.
Well, she loves
there.
Dancing.
She loves dance.
She says
yeah.
that music to her is all about the way dance filters through her body.
Yes, and I think you can hear it in the music. And Pam was very funny because she said, oh gosh, when directors send me choices of music, I always say no, you know. But she heard this and she said she loved it. And, you know, it's called Breathing Statues. And I always think that dance can again find a way in for people to hear the music.
Breathing Statues by Anna Klein from the ballet Secret Things, performed by the Calidore String Quartet. Kevin O'Hare, you've been at the Royal Ballet for over 10 years now, but what do you do to escape the world of Covent Garden when you want a completely different feel?
I love travel. I love to get away. And the old saying was, you know, join the Navy and see the world. I mean, I joined the ballet and saw the world, but that still hasn't stopped my love of travel. And any time I can, going away and finding a new culture, something to learn, and also then sometimes just to lie on a beach as well.
What piece of music would you like to have to finish with?
I mean, I love Forest Requiem, and I do wistfully think if I'm moving on to another world, that might be the music that would send me off. I think it's just so glorious. And I think maybe one of the reasons I love it even more is that I've never danced it. So I listen to the music as an audience member would listen to the music.
Well, I'm glad to say, Kevin O'Hare, that looking at you now, I think there's a long way before you slip off into another world. However, you do have to slip off. So it only remains for me to say thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Jesu from the Requiem by Gabrielle Fauré. The soprano was Barbara Bonney with the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Michel Legrand. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, Kevin O'Hare, the director of the Royal Ballet. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week at the same time, Michael will be talking to the film editor and sound designer, Walter Murch. This is BBC Radio 3. In a couple of minutes, today's lunchtime concert, featuring the cellist Jean-Guyen Queyras. But first, with the time at 1 o'clock, the latest BBC News, read by me, John Shea. A third group of hostages abducted by Hamas from Israel just over 7 weeks ago is expected to be released from Gaza today. The hostages will be freed in exchange for a number of Palestinians being held in prison as part of a four-day truce between Israel and Hamas. Doctors caring for some of the 13 Israeli hostages released by the group after a delay yesterday have said they didn't need any emergency medical intervention. 6 Palestinian women and 33 children and teenagers were freed from Israeli jails. The pause in fighting in Gaza is continuing and more humanitarian aid has been allowed into the territory. Separately, the armed wing of Hamas has announced the deaths of 4 of its commanders, including the head of its North Gaza Brigade. It didn't say when they were killed. In the occupied West Bank, medics say 6 Palestinians, including 2 children, have been killed in an Israeli military operation in Jenin overnight. The Israeli army said the raid had targeted a man suspected of carrying out a deadly attack 3 months ago. Demonstrators are gathering in London ahead of a march against anti-Semitism. Police expect as many as 50,000 people to take part. The organisers say the protest is taking place because Jews do not feel safe in the capital. A nationwide curfew is in force in Sierra Leone following a night of gunfire in the capital, Freetown. The president says his government is in control after unidentified gunmen attacked a military barracks and tried to break into an arms depot. The leader of the Reform UK party, Richard Tice, has denied offering money to try to persuade the Conservative MP, Lee Anderson, to defect. Mr. Tice has told the BBC that no cash or money was in any way offered after a report in the Sunday Times. The former manager of the England men's football team, Terry Venables, has died after a long illness. He was 80. Terry Venables managed England for 2 years, most notably leading them to the Euro 96 semi-finals on home soil. And the weather. Cloud and spells of rain will move eastwards this afternoon. There'll be sunny spells in parts of Scotland, with showers in the far north. It's 2 minutes past one.
On BBC Sounds.
I'm Ringo and I play the drums.
I'm Paul and I play bass.
I'm George and I play a guitar.
I'm John and I too play a guitar. Sometimes I play the fool.
Marking the release of their final ever single, this is the story of how the Fab Four came to be, with newly unearthed archive rediscovered after 60 years and brand new interviews with Paul McCartney.
It was, wow, this is it. Now it's a Beatle record.
And Ringo Starr.
It blows me away that every generation